Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 9. This week, we talk with Greg Levenhagen about his experience on mobile development, comparing Swift and C#, share the icon no one agrees on, and Apple uses Windows on Mac Pro production lines. Hello, I'm Jason Young, and with me is my co-host, Carl the Beard Schweitzer. How's it going, Carl?
That's not the first time this week I've been introed as that. That's pretty funny.
Are you serious?
Yeah, well, this week I co-taught some interns on mobile development, and that was brought up during my introductions as well. So
they called you the Beard?
Yes, just like that.
I didn't even know that. I'd have never heard you call that. I just made that up.
Well, more and more people are starting to notice that the icon that I put on all my avatars now is the one with, you know, me with the big stocky glasses and the beard.
Right.
So that's what people are starting to pick up on.
So that's your brand. So now you can never cut it.
Yeah. Which is good, because then I, you know, when my wife tells me I need to trim it, I just said, I can't. It's out of my hands.
It's the image. So this week we have Greg Levenhagen on. How's it going, Greg?
It's going very well. Thanks for having me.
Yep. So I've actually worked with Greg for a while back in the days whenever I worked at Skyline, and him and I work on New Doug together, and our paths seem to cross all the time. I know you were out at Build. Pretty much everywhere I go, I end up seeing you there. There's probably a 50-50 chance that I see you there. So you want to give a little introduction about yourself?
Yeah. So first, New Doug, right? Acronym SOUP. So that's the Northeast Wisconsin Developers User Group. Mm-hmm. Jason and I run that along with another individual as well. I've been going on for about 8 years. I'm also one of the board members for that conference, which is at thatconference.com. That's a professional level national style conference. I'm a Microsoft MVP in client development, which is one of the newer MVP categories. So that kind of means the larger scale of Windows 8 apps, Windows Phone, hopefully soon Xbox apps, you know, and of course WPF, like the desktop side.
Okay. That's pretty cool.
And, so I work for Skyline Technologies as a consultant covering Midwest area, and been doing a lot with, client development, Azure, Android, iOS development. So
a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Perfect. So, let's jump into the news. Some interesting stories, this week. So the first one, this one made its way around Twitter quite a bit. So this one is about comparing Swift and C#. So we talked about this a little bit on our last show. We talked about the new language that Apple came up with, which is this Swift language. And somebody actually went through, it looks like his name is Chris Pietschman, it looks like. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct. But he actually went through and he showed, you know, declaring constants and variables, integer bounds, type inference, you know, string comparison, a whole bunch of the language basics. He just compared Swift and C# side by side. And this was really helpful for people like me that, you know C#. And I don't know what stuck out to you guys, how much you've looked through this.
Yeah, so I had gone through it, found it on Twitter, and I found that, you know, one of the big initial attractions is, okay, garbage collection, you know, so more modern language for the average developer. We also have type inference within Swift now. So instead of using var like C#, you know, we can use C# style var in Swift, but we can also use let if you're doing like constants. Okay. And so that's a little bit like on the F# side of things, the keyword let. What I found striking though most is similarity in the style, which isn't really, I guess, too surprising once given a little bit of thought with the C style syntax, because you'll find that between C# and Java and other C based languages. But taking it even further, you know, I heard on somewhere in conversation that was it Oracle won the lawsuit about APIs with Android.
Okay, I did not hear that one. I knew that there was the lawsuit. So they won. So what was their, I can't remember what their position was. Did they say you could copyright an API? Was that what it was?
Yeah, and so let's be clear in that they won the current state, I guess.
Right.
I'm sure there's more appeals or up to the Supreme Court. But yeah, so the Java API as it currently stands is owned under Oracle, which means that Android can't expose like a new implementation using the Java interface, which I find, frankly, pretty crazy.
Right.
Because if I start, the example that came to me was, well, what about like max and it takes int x comma int y? Like how many times has that been implemented? And, you know, that's part of Java. So does Oracle now own that? And I can never make that footprint, method signature.
Wow.
So, you know, going back to Swift on this level, you know, like some of the names are, instead of like starts with, it's has prefix in Swift. Mm-hmm. You know, the two upper, two lower is uppercase string and lowercase string. So there's subtleties like that.
Do you think they were intentionally trying to keep the names different so that they wouldn't look like C sharp?
I think there's probably part of that. And in all honesty, maybe the court case ruling with, Apple wouldn't want to be their own, right? Mm-hmm. But they might want to avoid the lawsuits as well. I just think that overall that it's kind of foolish to have those be copyrightable or patentable. I'm not sure which it fell under. I'm assuming copyright.
Yeah, my understanding is it was copyright, and that it's just unfathomable what the implications of that are for software in general.
Right. Right.
So what I found interesting though about this Swift language, I mean, just looking through it and comparing it to C sharp, I mean, my reaction was, my first reaction was that they should have just used C sharp, but of course we know Apple would never do that. Even though that was probably the right thing to do, but, ignoring that for a moment, I was just thinking, and maybe this is what they were trying to do was, hey, I can actually write this. Like I looked at Objective-C and it was pretty appalling. So I never really wanted to touch it. I've always looked at, you know, Xamarin, and I've used Xamarin before, but this actually makes it so that, you know, when I look at Xamarin versus this, and Xamarin has a price tag, I think Xamarin's worth it, but I might look at the two and I might say, you know, for this particular application, I might just use what they give me.
Yeah. And so I think the positioning that they've put themselves in, like you just highlighted, is spot on, because especially when we consider Xamarin and the new Roslyn compiler being open sourced, mm-hmm. I would expect that Microsoft and Xamarin will partner so that, you know, sometime in the next year, Xamarin is actually using Roslyn,
right,
and make it even easier to do the cross-platform dev. And so I definitely think that this has a play from a marketing strategy of, hey, we need to kind of get with the times, because although I, you know, in the 90s, I was basically all C, C++. And so it wasn't hard for me to pick up Objective-C. But I definitely have heard that same sentiment a lot from people coming from the .NET and Java worlds, mm-hmm. that hadn't had the raw C experience, because it's not just picking up raw C. It is a different style with its kind of message passing, and calling in Objective-C. If you would have really spent maybe a week head down, like it probably would have started clicking a little bit better.
Right. Right.
But it is different. That's for sure. And Swift is definitely more on par with the C sharp Java developers.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on this, Carl?
Well, I agree with most of what you guys said. You know, it is a very familiar feel to somebody who does have experience with C sharp. But, like I said, I was talking with an iOS developer, yesterday, and you still kind of have to know the Objective-C way of doing things. You have to know its framework either way.
Right.
So if you're going to be developing on that platform and you're not used to that platform, there's going to just be some overhead anyways, learning the styles and the ways that they do things over there. So, at the same point, that's all, you know, mostly what you have to learn. There shouldn't be as much from the language standpoint if you use something like Swift.
Do they allow semicolons on these lines here? Is it optional?
It's optional from what I read.
Because that would drive me crazy.
Yeah, I remember reading specifically that you don't have to type a semicolon. So,
but you can.
I'm assuming it's optional, right?
Okay. Because it's just like a period at the end of a sentence whenever I type, you know?
Just right. Unfortunately, I haven't downloaded and played with this yet because I only have one environment to develop for iOS, and I can't move to iOS 8 yet. So.
Oh, I gotcha. Any final comments on that? Should we move on?
Yep. Sure.
So the next one here, this one was kind of interesting. This one, and it's sort of obvious, but you know, I think it's still worth saying. It's the title of this blog post was people hate to register. So the idea here is that, you know, there's a lot of websites that we use where we just don't like to register. Like it's a huge barrier to entry. If you look at like Google Analytics, they have this portion of Google Analytics where you get this kind of funnel view. And if you instrument your pages properly, you can look at this funnel where, you know, you could use this funnel for like a checkout process on a website. And you can say, hey, at the top of the funnel, this is all the people that come to my website. The next part of the funnel, the smaller portion, is, you know, all the people that add an item to the cart. And as you go through the different stages of checkout, you can sort of see like where you're losing people. Like if your checkout process has 10 steps, you're going to lose people, right? You're going to lose more than if you have 3 easy to use steps. And sometimes there's just one step that's just really terrible. So the notion here, and this isn't really talking about e-commerce sites, but it's talking about sites that where they really don't actually need to have a registration. And, you know, I totally agree with this. So I know before on the show, I've talked about this website that I have for doing this real-time logging. It's called logforstuff.com. And on that one, I was pretty adamant about, hey, I don't want people to, you know, have to create an account. You don't even have the option to create an account. What you end up doing is you create any kind of ID that you want. And you sort of get your own URL basically. And that's what this article is talking about. So you go in there, you do your thing, you get your own URL, and that's kind of your place on their website. So I thought it was a clever article.
And I can really empathize with that too, because there's a lot of times where I go to a site through a link or something and just to check out some content, and all of a sudden they want me to sign up, and mm-hmm. I'll just stop right there. If there's not a value that I need to get out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit different if I'm doing some e-commerce and, you know, I'm doing some paid transaction or something. I expect there to be a little bit of overhead, and it's comfortable to have register and have some sort of, you know, sign up. That way you can go back and check on the status of whatever you're purchasing. But, you know, if there's, you're just providing somebody some information or some content of source that, you know, you don't need that kind of transaction with. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that this is the best way to handle that, but it's really a good concept to at least get you thinking, you know, how do I do this so I can actually engage with the people? Because mm-hmm. if people can't access your content, then you're not engaging with them.
Yeah, this is definitely the trend. I mean, we've already seen this happen with logins, right? People don't want to create an account to use your site. You know, use your own login, but if they can use like Twitter or Facebook or Live or something like that to log in, you know, a lot of people will opt for that. So I think we're going to, you know, we could see that continue to evolve where, you know, those some centralized services that we trust end up having more and more information that we want to share. And then we just end up, you know, sort of authorizing that site. Yeah, go ahead. You know, I'm trying to purchase something from them. Go ahead and you know, give them the money or give them just the bare minimum what they need to know to charge my card or whatever.
So I think there's several points that have from this discussion that have come up to me. Mm-hmm. One is I think that the broad user base probably needs to understand what it means to sign up with Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Microsoft, mm-hmm. because generally speaking, you know, and speaking as a developer, I know that you in basic only get, you know, the email or a unique ID, and you don't ever see the password, and you don't get like all of the friends and everything else. Well, Facebook is a little bit different, but that's how the developer sets up the app.
Right.
And I think that misconception from using like the OAuth type approach on a website is really because of the mobile phones, because a lot of times the apps will take, I'll just ask for all this stuff in case I need it in the future.
Yeah, location services. We want to be able to read your calendar, read your email. And it's like, this is just a fart app.
Right. And I think that's given the mass consumers a bad impression, and rightfully so, because mm-hmm. the majority of those apps do not need all that content. The other thing from this side is, you know, having to have implemented scenarios like this blog post is talking about, it definitely produces more throughput. So like where the partial shopping cart is the example I've had to work with. And you're gathering information the entire time because of marketing type stuff, but it's not forcing the user to do it. So they can go partially through and they may be any percentage from 0 to 100 with actually completing the step. Mm-hmm. And until they actually complete the purchase, like they don't really have a full account. You may have gotten their email, you may have gotten their name or address or something, but they can back out at any time. And by not forcing them to do all that right up front, those clients that I've worked with have seen greater success, like is pointed out here. Mm-hmm. And the last point I was going to say is specifically when I'm browsing sites on a mobile device, if the first thing I see, or if I download an app and the first thing I see in order to get any useful stuff out of it is to register an account, I almost always just delete the app or go to another site.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to be really gun shy about using, you know, something like my Live account to authenticate another application. And that I stayed like that for a long time. And then I actually went to implement some authentication using Live ID or Live as a provider. And what I realized, they don't even give you the email address. Like you Correct. Get, you just get like some, I think some generic ID. And it's really all it tells you is, hey, I saw this same person. You know, if they log in a second time, you're like, oh yeah, you were that person that logged in before, you know, 87539.
Right.
So it's really not sharing a lot of information.
Yeah. And Twitter and Google may give the email. Facebook's a little different. So I've registered mm-hmm. some Facebook apps to do the authentication like that. And so, but Facebook's good. When a developer wires it up like that, Facebook will actually bring you to a web page and tell you what's being requested. But it's, yeah, the Microsoft is the best one in that it doesn't even give the email.
Yeah. And I see it as like its generic purpose in life is to just prove who you are and nothing else. Like the Facebook, I don't know. It's just, that's sort of tied to a whole bunch of my information. And I really don't like to use it for that. Google is sort of in the middle, but, so I tend to use my Live ID when I just want to prove my identity and nothing else. The only time I use the Twitter one is if it is something that's social and it's something that sort of relates to Twitter, you know, for like comments or something like that, I'll actually use Twitter to log in.
Well, and so you bring up another interesting point. So, I just went through this with redoing that conference website where we wanted to, enable we're largely technical attendance, right? For about 1,000 developers. So mm-hmm. we wanted to make sure that we had as many available as we could. So I actually don't think we included Facebook, but we did Twitter, Microsoft, Google, Stack Overflow. And then we actually do our own OAuth provider as well. But the important thing there, what I'm bringing up is that provide the choice, because what you just explained makes sense for you, mm-hmm. but maybe somebody else uses Google Plus for work and Microsoft for personal stuff. And, you know, so they have their own relation. So I think the importance there is for the developers to give the choices for the different accounts that makes sense, because there's a lot of sites out there that offer it. It's not just these major 4 or 5 we're talking about.
Right. And it's so easy now to implement in .NET in the later versions. It's so easy.
Yeah, when I've done it several times now with the new Owen stuff, and it's some of them is just uncommenting a line, and the majority of them is pasting in your consumer key and consumer secret, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden you're good.
Exactly. So up next, share the icon that no one agrees on. So this actually this has some history to it, but the article itself was talking about all of the different share icons. So no matter what platform you pick, they all have a different icon for sharing. Windows 8 has this little like circle with dots on it that really makes no sense. Windows Phone 7 had a little gift, which doesn't make any sense. Apple's just got a box with an arrow, which sort of makes sense to me. Android, it makes the least amount of sense. It's like 3 dots with... with lines connecting them.
It's almost like a network, you know, node.
Oh,
you know.
That's what it. Okay. I did not get that. Okay.
The one I like the most is the one that's on the far right. It's the open share icon.
Yeah.
But if you look at it, it's an abstract hand with the, you know, somebody yep. passing something to somebody else. So, but when you just glance at it, it just kind of looks like a, you know, a weird stylistic circle. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is, you know, I agree with what this article says, you know, This is, you know, a simple thing that we all understand is sharing. You know, I want to give this whatever it is to somebody else, mm-hmm. but there's just no good pictograph, no, you know, icon or image that we can all agree upon that, yes, that, and, you know, 90% of the people out there can say that's sharing. So one of the first things that I did when I saw this article is, for most of my apps, I generate my icons with a product from Syncfusion called Metro Studio. And I they have a little search box in there. I typed in share. And I get about, you know, 50 or 60 different icons that are all different. They cover all of these that are up there, plus more different kind of concepts. So, you know, even on that level with somebody who's providing icon packages, they realize that there are so many different ways to represent this.
Yeah, we just all need to get along and pick standards, because I even with the Windows, like the Windows share icon, I think it's confusing. If everybody used it, I don't think it would be confusing. I don't think everybody needs to adopt that one, but it'd be great if there was some way that we could just all get on the same page here. And I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, right? It's just going to keep going like this.
So let's consider if everybody used it. I like that scenario brought up.
Yep.
My niece and nephew have no concept of what a floppy disk is.
Right.
And yet that's the universal save icon. And they know that, but they've never actually even seen a floppy disk, and specifically a 3.5-inch floppy.
Yep. So that was another link that we included here that you're sort of referencing here. So Scott Hanselman had a post with a whole bunch of these icons, and he started out with that save icon. So go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted.
Well, the only other thing is if I, you know, kind of close my eyes and think, what do I picture somebody doing for a share? Mm-hmm. You know, go back to a kid, you know, so somebody, you know, little school boy standing there. I would imagine them having a ball in their hand, mm-hmm. and palm facing upward.
Yeah.
And so the closest thing I get to that is actually a hybrid of what Carl liked on the top right, and then scrolling down for the open hand so that you actually see the fingers. So the open hand by itself doesn't like give me a, hey, I'm trying to give you something.
Yeah.
But if there was like, say, a floating ball right above that hand, then it would make me think, hey, I'm trying to give you something or share something. But
that's a good point. I have a question for you, and I honestly don't know the answer to this. Is that, you know, is that universal across cultures too?
Yeah, I don't know. What's interesting about that is I don't have the answer, obviously, but mm-hmm. I would think that it's pretty close to being that way because, you know, across language barriers, the physical gesture would seem, you know, how else would you do it? Or would you throw it at, them? You know,
throw it at their face. I want to live there.
But I guess another miniature lesson that, you know, I kind of pulled out of this too is one of the things that kind of sparked, you know, this entire topic was the fact that Apple created a different way to show this than what they do on their other UIs. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of, you know, reminded me just to be consistent. So if there's something that I'm creating in one of my applications that I kind of remember to do it the same way when I mean to show somebody to do a very similar pattern. So not that I'm doing it one way here and I'm doing it slightly different in a different place. You know, I don't want to confuse my users.
Well, they don't want to stay boring. They want to keep reinventing themselves, apparently.
Well, part of the discussion we should consider is context as well. Although I agree with your point in that across the platform, you would think that they would use a similar icon, but perhaps it makes more sense depending on the app contextually, you know, to symbolize a share in that sense.
And then, you know, the post that I was talking about before with Hanselman, this was interesting. This was a older post. It was from, looks like it's going on 2 years ago now. And it was bringing up what you were talking about, where the floppy disk icon, you know, which floppies are dead. It was funny. My wife's school in sort of their student, code of conduct, they hadn't updated it. So it said that you couldn't, it said something about misusing diskettes in there, you know, and I said, she's like, what does this mean? I said, don't worry about it. You know, cause she just didn't use computers whenever, you know, she never really thought about disks and moving disks around. So yeah, our kids today are pushing the save button, they know that that's the save button, but they don't really know what it stands for. I think I told my older son one time and he's like, oh, that's cool. But he thinks of it as like a giant USB, thumb drive. And then radio buttons are another one. You know, I actually, you can find a lot of people, you know, that are younger than we are, And I'll be like, do you know what radio buttons are based off of? And they'll be like, no. And it's like, well, they were actually on a radio. Like, I remember doing this where you'd, you know, you'd actually push a button on a radio and it would go to that and the other one would pop back out. What else is here? Address books and calendars. Those are still pretty relevant.
Voicemail. The one that I find interesting, so I'm aware of some of these.
Yeah.
The one that jumps out to me is actually the phone handset.
Yeah.
Because I've been for the last, I don't know, 10 plus years with only a cell phone. And, you know, I see more and more families growing up where the parents will have cell phones and then they'll keep like a track phone or something for the kids at the house. But yeah, it doesn't look like the, you know, 8-inch long with a earpiece and a mouthpiece anymore.
Yeah. And actually it's funny because the picture here too shows a cord on the phone. And, I pointed that out to one of my kids. We were watching a movie and they had, you know, like the 20-foot cord, you know, in the kitchen where you could just sort of take it everywhere. And, I said, look at that cord. And they're like, what's that for? It's like, well, that was, you know, it wasn't wireless. It actually had a wire on it.
That's how it was for when I was a kid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then this one, I got a kick out of this one. There's a magnifying glass, and binoculars, and they're sort of backwards because find is binoculars. So what does it say here? It says magnifying glass became the search everywhere icon. But for some reason, binoculars are for searching within a document, but it doesn't make any sense because magnifying glasses are for searching things that are near and binoculars imply breadth of search and distance. So they're just backwards. Envelopes for mail. There's tools for the settings, which sort of makes sense, I guess. Microphone, I guess, isn't too out of date.
The television is one that, you know,
yeah, like, that with rabbit ears. Well, yeah, there's, so what does a new TV look like? It is just a rectangle, right?
Yeah. It looks like a monitor rectangle, right?
Yeah. Cause I mean, even the bezel, like there's some TVs where they're getting rid of bezels. I mean, we don't have there's no way to switch there. There's no, you know, rotary dial for changing the channel. So there's nothing distinctive about a current TV. So they have to show an old TV.
Well, I remember getting my Nintendo and hooking that up to, you know, a TV that had the rabbit ears and stuff. And every now and then I'd have to smack the side of it. You guys remember even doing that? Like, kids nowadays are like, you would smack a TV.
Yeah. And then there was the, you know, the coax cable, but then you also had the little adapter to switch off into the two wires or back and forth. And I used to have a box in the basement that had, I must've had 10, you know, 10 different adapters. I had some rabbit ears in there. And then I had all the different adapters to go like different directions for antennas. And, I think it was a couple of months ago. I'm like, why am I keeping these? I mean, I can't even imagine what I would use it for anymore. So I just threw it all away or took it to Best Buy cause they recycle that stuff. So up next, this one was interesting. And this one, Apple got a lot of flack for this one. So, Tim Cook on his Twitter feed, he was, I don't even know what he tweeted, but he was out there working on one of the Apple production lines, or he was, you know, checking it out, and it was this nice, photo opportunity, and they have some nice iMacs in the background that are hung up and showing some information. But what's interesting is that they are running Windows. So they're running Windows in the manufacturing plant. And, you know, I think a lot of Apple people were sort of heard about this, at least the people that were, you know, angry enough or got a kick out of it enough to, you know, to reply to the tweet of it. But here's the fact. I mean, this is so normal, so unbelievably normal. I guarantee in any Apple production facility, there's, you know, 50 machines that are running Windows, not just on the production lines, but the building automation systems, you know, any kind of systems that are, you know, there's probably a lot of copies of embedded Windows in different places. And if you go to the Microsoft campus and you look at certain teams, like the team that does, you know, Office for Mac, obviously, and they make some of the mobile apps, they all have a Mac. And I actually have people that I work with where they run Windows on a Mac. I mean, we're just, it's a different world. It's not, you know, you're not in just one camp or the other. It doesn't work like that anymore. So any other comments?
So I've been running primarily off my work laptop being a MacBook Pro, but I probably am in native Windows, I'd say 80% of the time on Windows 8, and it runs great. And then when I am developing for iOS or need something on the OS X side, it's booting into that, and I have Parallels to actually run the bootcamp partition. So I get the best of both worlds out of it. It's a little bit of necessity for me for developing on the iOS side. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm not surprised when I see images like this. It's over the last, I'd say maybe 6 years, it's those walls have really started to break down.
Right.
And frankly speaking, like when it comes to the specifics of making mobile apps, you know, we have to be multi-platform. Nobody these days wants to write just for one platform.
Right. And Apple has a huge advantage there, right? Because they can, like you said, with your Mac, you can run both OS X and you can run Windows. And unfortunately, that's the only way to do it. Like you can't legitimately run, you know, buy a Windows laptop and run OS X on it. So
I wouldn't call that an advantage for Apple. I would call them that Apple being strong arming the developers.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a forced advantage. Yeah, definitely. So and one thing that they definitely do right is the trackpad. I mean, you cannot beat that trackpad.
Yeah, the trackpad is nice. What I would love to see is, you know, either the solution for compiling iOS to be okayed for like in the cloud or something like that, where right. it's not as harsh, or you know, throw a long toss out there and say, hey, let's have Visual Studio using C# or maybe even Swift. Mm-hmm. On the Mac side so that I can write it in there and Microsoft benefit from having, you know, my MSDN as a service kind of thing or something like that. Right.
Yeah. But, you know, so Apple running, you know, Windows on here, it's pretty obvious why, right? They're the industry software for doing this type of work does not exist for OS X. It just does not exist. There's nothing out there to run your manufacturing plants, at least not that I've ever seen. And I, you know, I have a pretty good background in manufacturing and all the software that's out there, and just nobody writes it for OS X. So, I mean, Apple, this is just how it's done. And, I mean, they're using their own hardware, at least. It would be pretty bad if they were running, you know, a Dell with Windows hung up there, but even that would sort of be understandable if they, you know, they didn't necessarily customize this production line, right? This could have been, something they contracted out and they said, well, here's what it needs to do. And you know, they said, well, it has to have, you know, Apple computers, you know, maybe they put that, they specified that in there, but, the contractors had to, you know, they had to make it so that this fulfilled their requirements.
The other thing we could always throw out there is that, you know, maybe it's the keep your enemies closer type thing. And if yeah. if they don't use it, they don't know what's working and what doesn't work in their competitors.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't want to sort of group everybody at Microsoft in the same group. There's definitely a variety of people, but there definitely are people that, you know, have never touched a Mac. And, you know, I think it's important that people try everything, you know, try everything, see what works for you. See what, you know, sort of understand the pros and cons. Cause I've in my life, you know, I started out on an Apple and it was a Mac Plus, and that was back in, you know, that's not what I started. I started on a TRS-80. But the first Apple I started was a Mac Plus. And, you know, like I get their philosophy. I've used Apple products for a long time, and it just helps you understand, you know, different ways of doing things and what's the same, what's different, pros and cons. So I think everybody should take a look at both platforms. So, moving on. So Greg, the reason we had you on, we have a couple of reasons, but we have a whole bunch of questions for you. So like you mentioned earlier, you know, you work at Skyline Technology, so you get a lot of, experience working with clients on different applications. So you have a lot of experience there. So we wanted to ask some questions around that. So, why don't you kick it off, Carl?
Yeah. So one of the topics you said you were interested was talking about enterprise Windows 8 apps and Windows Phone apps. But before we even get going in that direction, what are we calling the Windows Store apps? Is it's not Metro? I've heard Windows Store. There's quite a few different names. With your experience, what is the nomenclature that we should phrase this as?
Great question. So, I actually have not specifically asked that on some of the internal threads in Microsoft, but that's because I was given a formal answer through, I don't know what they're called now, but it was Microsoft Learning at the time, I think, during the reorg last summer that changed. But so when they got rid of the Metro name, I was given four names, depending
just to
on,
keep it clear,
on context. And so those names, like if you're talking about the design, it was the Windows Modern UI. Mm-hmm. If it was apps, it was Windows Store apps. Mm-hmm. instead of just Metro, and you know, where people would say Metro app, it was Windows Store app. Those two kind of cover the vast majority of it. What's interesting now with, I think, maybe it was 6 months ago, or not even 6 months ago, maybe four, Microsoft announced that they're in the process of merging the stores. So now, like, we see that developers really only have to register in one place, and that's active. On the back end, there's still more work to be done there. So it'll be interesting when, you know, they've said, okay, we call the Windows 8 Metro apps, we really call them Windows Store apps. Well, how does that differentiate between phone and non-phone devices, right? So that's probably another name change that we'll have coming up. You know, we'll see out of Microsoft within the next year or so.
Yeah, whenever I'm the time that this actually matters is when I'm searching for information. So what I'll do is, you know, I want to know how to do something specific, and I'll sort of tack on. I either use XAML as a search term, or I'll put in, you know, Windows Store, you know, or even Windows Store app, so that it, you know, sort of knows how to qualify right. that.
So I've done a lot of work on both the XAML and the JavaScript sides for these off of WinRT based apps, and so WinRT. That gets interesting because of the whole Windows RT, Surface RTs. And so there's confusion among that, I find, even among developers. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing the JavaScript side, throwing in WinJS usually, helps narrow down those searches quite a bit.
Okay. The nice thing is going forward, I mean, you mentioned, you know, not knowing what it's going to be called with the whole Universal app, but I guess for the most part, it's just not really going to matter, right? Because you don't think of them as two platforms anymore.
For the most part, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, if you know, I know we're audio only here, but if you kind of envision a Venn diagram that has two circles, mm-hmm. With say 98% of them overlapping, I mean, that's what we're going to end up with. We're very close to it already. Mm-hmm. Where WinRT, you know, is the main piece there, whether it's the XAML side or the JavaScript side. And then you get phone specific stuff. And my understanding is that it'll never be 100% overlap, because there are just features on a phone that are not on a tablet or a laptop, like the call features. Now, maybe 10 years from now that changes and our laptops have the ability to make actual cell phone type calls. But until that kind of feature set arrives, you know, we'll see something a little bit different.
Yeah. I wonder if that'll turn into, like, you know, sort of like how the JavaScript checks work, right? So you say, like, if device, you know, can make call, or, you know, is call capable or something like that.
Correct. And so looking, you know, since Windows 8, the 8.0 API exposed, you know, functionality for us, like location, microphone, and the camera, which were three capabilities outside of all the others that you always have to check for, because at any given time, a user can go and take the permission away. Mm-hmm. So you're always checking for those as a, you know, kind of a best practice or successful pattern. And so you bring up a great point. I mean, that's definitely one argument to simplify the API differences. Now, for full disclosure and transparency on that, we should also then consider Windows 8 industry and Windows Phone 8 mm-hmm. embedded. So those two things add a little bit more of a slice, where the Windows Phone embedded gives you two more namespaces specifically with locking down the phone and mobile device management namespaces. And then the Windows 8 Windows 8 industry adds, I think, like eight different namespaces, a little bit more on that.
Do you want to give some background and explain those two different concepts to us, the industry and the embedded?
Right. So it gets interesting with those. The marketing hasn't quite been there from what I've seen. I find a lot of people haven't gotten up to speed entirely on those, but there's definitely a market for, like say in retail, for the employees that are working inside of a retail shop, or truck drivers that are moving around, and the companies want to provide devices for them that can be locked down. So they're not used like a traditional mobile phone would be, but they're on a secure network. They can push updates automatically and control who has access, like for login. So it's really giving you a mobile presence that the company is fully in control of. And it's not the sense of where all of a sudden you need to carry another phone, like where you have your personal and your other one, like if you're on call in the IT world. This is more of like a location aware, you know, like you're in the store and doing specific workflows. And it's all about allowing those enterprises to really come to grips and get that done. And of course, there's the whole BYOD for the bring your own device type movement. But as we find that even with some VPN solutions on these, and some of the platforms allow for what you call different profiles, they just don't solve the problem. And so the embedded and the industry versions of Windows Phone and Windows 8 really do get us there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what, in your experience working with these customers, what kind of interest have you seen in the enterprise for making, you know, these new store apps, I guess is what we're calling them?
So I have seen interest. We've mm-hmm. had a couple clients. The typical path is more or less that clients want to understand kind of the platform as a whole, you know, because over the last 2 years, they just want to see, is this going to stay? Is it too new? You know, enterprises tend to be a little bit slower to adopt. And so our typical entry point is actually usually making something that isn't business critical. Maybe it's a public thing, you know, so in the case of retail or where they have interaction with customers and consumers, that we make them like location-based apps or something like that. And it's an entry point, right? It's like one foot in the door. And then they see how that's successful, and then we can move on from there. So we've done, you know, I've worked on apps where we have a dashboard type setup for a manufacturing warehouse mm-hmm. where they can see they have a whole bunch of electronical devices. So we actually used Windows 8 as the dashboard and SignalR, and it was talking to all these devices. And so, you know, you'd see visual indicators from a little bit far away, and they would flash red then if something was wrong with that individual device, and they'd have hundreds of these things where they could easily go through. That's one example, you know, so that's non-deployed to the store. Mm-hmm. They have full access, but that's not used by a whole bunch of people, you know, in their hand. Like, you know, it's not like 200 installs. It's really the dashboard. On the other side, you know, getting in an enterprise type app in front of a whole bunch of people, we have an inventory system we built for a client. You know, I designed it out and had it all configured. They bought a bunch of surfaces, and they've put on 80 different tow motors or forklifts, whatever your area calls them. Mm-hmm. So as people are moving around inventory within their warehouse, they're using the touch-based system. Before that, they had nothing, actually.
Oh, wow.
They were doing stuff by paper, and a lot of it was getting lost. And so now, by actually being able to track current orders, they're able to, you know, hyper optimize what's actually going on within their warehouse because of this enterprise based app. The next strategy is actually taking in the data that they're getting from this and putting it into some kind of BI solution, a business intelligence solution, so that they can actually even, you know, forecast and predict even better. So just by having the touch based, you know, interface and right there on a tablet being able to be mounted. And it was, you know, some of the guys at that client had already known XAML. So we went in, did about a week's worth of training, and I worked with them, and it's a great deliverable. They're really happy with it.
Yeah. I see that as a pretty big you know, revolution in manufacturing is getting screens in front of people, not just trying to replace paper, but trying to do optimizations, you know, so giving me the information that I want, you know, when I want it, and also being able to pull that information, you know, instead of saying, you know, drive here, I can be like, hey, you know, how many more orders we have stacked up, you know, what happens if this, you know, this happens. So.
Well, and that's one of the things that I get really excited about with the actual change in the Metro style of interface, mm-hmm. because the whole content over Chrome is really a big movement. And myself and a couple of my coworkers and even people in the larger community, like say Billy Hollis, have been, you know, being a proponent of saying, hey, you don't need 10,000 records in this grid. Like, it's not making you more productive. Mm-hmm. And so the whole content over Chrome of like notifying, providing them what they're actually trying to work on and notifying them of situations that they need to handle, right? It goes more towards it lets manage the exceptions rule rather right. than see all 100%. I want to see the 5% that actually need my attention. And it makes the UI much more intuitive, and it allows them to get better work and quicker work done. Right. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that a lot, you know, with the Windows 8 style of apps kind of come to play.
Okay. So now that you know, we have this concept of universal apps where you can write, you know, share a ton of logic and code between your, you know, sort of desktop tablet app and your phone app. Have you seen, you know, that really have an impact, you know, in the interest from the enterprise?
Not yet. No.
Okay.
Unfortunately. And I think that's really only been 2 months out, to public. Mm-hmm. And I think the sales cycles for enterprises tend to be, you know, a little bit slower than that. Mm-hmm. In that time frame, I've had two clients start up new Windows 8 projects, and, you know, by doing some simple education on the universal apps, you know, they're taking that route, and now they'll get that out of the box. But that wasn't a driving factor for them to make the app in the first place. Mm-hmm. Not that I've seen it yet.
So that's, at this point, it's just a nice to have, you know, since we're already making this app for you, if we structure it this way, we could easily give you the other one as well.
Correct. And I think over time, I think that one, that's going to drastically help the Windows Phone platform. So my personal insight on this is really when you walk into the stores, the retail stores that are selling laptops and tablets, you know, 80% of them are running Windows 8 and whatever else it's going to be, you know, Windows 9 or whatever. And so it's only a matter of time between the Xbox Ones showing the modern UI and the desktops. And once people start to realize, hey, this actually for a BYOD device allows me to more seamlessly integrate with things that I want to on my phone. I see that as kind of a really big push.
Now, the companies that are starting to go these routes with taking these, you know, chances on the newer style Windows Store apps, it is the fact that they're using them make them more open to using other products from Microsoft, like going to Azure and using some of that as their backend infrastructure for these? Or are they kind of independent yet at this point?
Great question. So full disclosure, my company's Azure practice was, I think, if I get the title right, Central Region Partner of the Year for Azure for last year. And so we definitely try and, you know, make our clients aware of that. In the case of the forklift tow motor enterprise app, you know, we gave them a little dog and pony show about Azure, and that whole IT department is moving to Azure, 100% of it. So all the way from Office 365 SharePoint, I've moved over a couple of their Linux sites that were at a competitor. You know, actually, I'm going to bash them a little bit because it was Rackspace, and Rackspace doesn't allow you to export the VMs at all in a non-proprietary format. So that caused a little trouble. But once I was able to export that, you know, those are now sitting in Linux VMs. We moved over their marketing, had a couple WordPress sites. Those are now hosted in Azure websites. So yeah, once they saw kind of the play of what we could do with Windows 8 and synchronizing some of that data in Azure, you know, from that enterprise app, it really opened the door for a much, much wider scenario.
Cool. So what, whenever you're, you know, working with these businesses, developing these apps, what kind of, you know, what are the biggest roadblocks and pain points that, you know, are keeping or slowing them down or maybe even keeping them from adopting, you know, this technology?
Well, so on two different fronts there, right? The client side, and then there's the Azure side. I guess since we were just talking about Azure, I'll take that first.
Sure. It'd be great to hear about both for sure.
The biggest educational piece on the Azure side is that the jobs are not disappearing. For whatever reason, I think it's just largely communication and perception that the system administrator types still feel that their job is threatened. And when we talk to them about, no, it's really just you're using a different set of tools. And if anything, it actually adds a little bit of work. But, you know, when we look at it from they're already using a co-location or somebody else that they just don't consider the cloud, but it is externally hosted. You know, we go through assessment and say, well, how much are you spending per month on this kind of stuff? And every single time that I've had that on the Azure side over the last several years, actually since 2009, I've never had a client that has said, oh, here's what we're spending on our infrastructure pieces. We always say, okay, we'll do a month to 3 months worth of stuff and we'll come back and figure it out. And on average, Azure's about a third of the cost. And that gets the management eyes open. And then we have that discussion again with the system administrators and kind of walk them through stuff. And they're like, oh, I can do this and I can do that. And it's, you know, it's becoming much less of a barrier, but it still takes educational pieces there. And from the developer side on Azure, we rarely, if ever, see static or you know, a pushback. Most of the time, the devs are like, oh, you mean I can actually have a staging server for the website by just spinning it up in an Azure account and not have to wait 6 weeks and worry about permissions and everything else?
Yeah, it's empowering.
It's very empowering, you know, so the production site, you know, will still be under the full control, but their test QA and they can easily set up the continuous builds and push out the app. It also allows for them to test scalability a little bit easier. So the developers are usually right on board, and that's only fueled by Visual Studio getting better and better integration with Azure. You know, the latest piece of being able to debug from within Visual Studio out into Azure is just tremendously. That a lot of eyes are just like, whoa, really? Like, awesome. And I think I think it's, you know, out of the three hats, the devs don't really have much. The system administrators, once they get into it, like it, and then it usually takes talking about the money aspects to get win over the managers. So before I move on to the Windows 8 side, any follow-up questions on the Azure side or?
No, that was very insightful.
So on the Windows 8 side, it's interesting. A lot of people in, you know, most of our clients, I think we only have one that's an international level client at this point. Most of our clients are national based. And so fighting market share is one of the biggest things in that, you know, it's, I don't know, I don't remember what the newest ones are. Maybe you guys do, but it's something like 40% and 48% for iOS and Android. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about the mobile stuff, that's always a, well, shouldn't we just do one or two of those and see how it kind of goes? And that, of course, you know, it that brings up the conversations about Xamarin, PhoneGap. If just doing a mobile-based website, you know, so a responsive design, you know, that handles mobile first. So we have to go through those kind of conversations. Largely what we end up seeing at this point in time, since Windows 8 is still kind of in the larger uptake, like I was talking about, with, you know, the newer machines in people's houses and employment, you know, still on the uptake of Windows 8. We see it when the clients have more control over it. So like if, say they've, one of my clients has, you know, hundreds of salespeople out and about, and they don't actually offer the salespeople, mobile phones specifically to use, but the vast majority of them all will have iOS. Well, then they only want to create the iOS device. And so when we have the conversations with them and we're like, okay, but managing it, you need to do this and have a MDM, a mobile device management system set up, and then worry about pushes and updates and security because it's your content. And so those all become conversations that clients tend to start backing away from until we talk about some of the stuff I mentioned earlier with like the embedded devices and having, you know, domain credentials, and that it works with Office and Outlook in the proper security fashions on the Windows platform, which starts to take up the conversation quite a bit better on the Microsoft side.
Mm-hmm. So are there, or do you have any more?
No, go ahead.
I was going to ask if there's any specific industries or maybe qualities that a business might have that would make them more open to developing these types of apps.
Well, the biggest industry that we don't see moving yet is medical, or that I don't see moving yet. Now, you know, we do our best to discuss, like on the, specifically like on the Azure side, that, you know, it is HIPAA and PCI compliant and everything, but that's just the data center piece, right? Mm-hmm. The developers, of course, still have to write secure software, which is a whole other movement. You know, it seems like over the last year and a half, that a lot of our industry is becoming more and more security conscientious, which is I think a really good thing. But from, you know, going from the medical side, being a little bit more hesitant to make the jump to the mobile apps and the cloud. On the manufacturing side, we see a lot more that they are willing, because they tend to be in kind of a closed circuit, you know, full control of the environment. I'm not sure, Jason, you find that one with your manufacturing clients?
It varies. I mean, I don't think there's, you know, any one, I don't think we can group them all together, but, you know, that's one thing I'm working on is with my partners, I'm trying to, you know, sort of draw a vision and stories like yours with the forklift truck and, you know, sort of the value that it provides there, and drawing a picture of what manufacturing can look at in a couple of years. Right. You know, that really helps people start to see the vision. And the more people start doing it, it just starts to snowball, because, you know, all of their excuses for not doing it go away, because it's like, well, hey, this other, you know, company B is doing this, you know, your competitor is doing this, and they're very successful, because they're doing this. And then they're like, oh, well, I'm interested in it.
One of the biggest things that, you know, so just having the tablets for, you know, specifically like on a Windows 8 style, one of the plays, like in a manufacturing sense, what we really like to try and push is the integration. So whether that's Bluetooth or USB for like, say, barcode scanners, or, you know, if we start getting into Internet of Things, mm-hmm. where some of those things can talk and you get that dashboard and that interaction while you're out on the floor, those could become really big. And once we, have the Kinect, so we've done some work for retail. We've been trying to break into a medical side of Kinect. It's a little bit more of a fringe on that area, but when we start realizing the, you know, the accuracy and what the Kinect can actually provide, and have that into, say, a Windows 8 app where it's, you know, quick and easy and touch based, the amount of details that can collect for, say, safety on a shop floor, there's a lot of potential within that stuff. So, mm-hmm. My impression is that, yes, we're over the last 2 years, we've seen a lot of the uptake in the modern style apps. And that road is set to explode.
Yeah, definitely. So we're starting to run out of time here, but I did want to talk to you about that conference. I know you mentioned it earlier in the show. But we wanted to dive in a little bit. We just have a couple of questions for you here. So, one thing that I wanted to know is if you have, you know, if there's anything new this year that, it hasn't happened in the previous years that people should be really excited for.
Great question. We have a couple things lined up. I don't know if I can commit to some of them publicly. For one, we've added a few more speakers this year. So I think last year we had 100, and I want to say this year's 115 or 120. So a lot more great content. So first and foremost, we are that professional developer conference. Kind of on the side of the convention center, we have some spare rooms where we actually have, family tracks. Last year we had 6 sessions for children. And this year we've doubled that to have 12 sessions. Mm-hmm. Wow. So we are a family friendly thing. So, you know, the idea is that, you know, the geek, we can go geek out with our peers, and then spouses can, you know, take the kids to the family tracks if they've had enough for the water park or, you know, that kind of stuff that the Wisconsin Dells has to offer.
Yeah. My kids loved that last year. The animals and the Legos, they just ate it up.
Yeah. 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 This, between like the Lego robotics and the Vex robotics stuff. And then, you know, I think we had a session on Scratch. And so, you know, we're trying to get involved more with, some people that do that on a regular basis with teaching kids about software development and bringing them in. But we still have great things, you know, like the pig roast for our social activity and a happy hour. We rent out the water park. We have a game night. We have additional activities like a code retreat. We have what we call a give camp where it's, you know, doing charitable type software development the weekend before. This year we'll be associating again with the Humanitarian Toolbox. You can check our website at that conference to get all new kinds of information on that. Tickets are on sale right now. It's only $3.99. So, excuse me, we are a non-profit and put all the money back into it and keep the cost as low as we can for the attendees, but give them a, you know, a national level type conference that's comparable to the ones that cost over $2,000.
Yeah, I know I had a really good time there last year. Knowing what, you know, all the talks and all the presenters as well as you do that are scheduled this year, what talks and presenters are you most excited to see and hear?
That's a great thing. It takes a good 12 plus hours after we've done several weeks of prep work to actually go through just the talks. Cause it's, I think it was like over 700 submissions this year. Now it gets really interesting. I'm interested in some of the Internet of Things additions. You know, that's kind of the new budding area for us. Us as general software developers. You know, some of the mobile stuff, there's some talks that I haven't got into those topics yet. But unfortunately, over the last several years running that conference, I think I totaled a session of one for attendance. So I don't get to actually attend most of those because, you know, while attendees are in session, I'm running around and making sure that sponsors are getting what they need and logistics is all happening and, you know, events are going on. So, you know, but I definitely look to my friends and coworkers to fill me in on what great content they got to see.
Well, even though you might not be able to see them all, you mentioned that you at least like powered through all 700, you know, entries that there were. Were there any interesting trends that you noticed, you know, maybe things that are people are more interested in or less interested in?
Yeah. From generally looking at the submission counts of topics, I think might be what you're getting at. Mm-hmm. We saw a big uptake in Angular submissions, Xamarin submissions, like, you know, kind of seeing where industry comes. I was actually asked this question, kind of in a private conversation of what's new. Because over the last couple of years, you know, we'd get a lot of submissions on something that wasn't really industry wide, like a lot of buzz about it yet. And this year was a little odd in that we didn't quite have one of those things where all of a sudden there was like 10 submissions about something that myself and the other board members hadn't really heard about yet. Which is, You know, I don't want to, you know, the whole causation correlation type thing, but, so I don't know if that means that there's not necessarily any kind of breaking thing. I tend to be very reluctant on thinking that. It's more or less that, either the people that have submitted haven't heard of it or not ready to talk about something like that yet. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to the Azure pick of the week, and I'm going to keep this one real short because of timing. One thing that was interesting this week was, Docker, which is the open source. It's an open source engine that, is interesting. It's very popular in the Linux world right now. It's sort of appeared out of nowhere, and it has this concept of using these containers for building applications to run on servers and in the cloud. So you sort of pack your application up in this container and run it anywhere. And Azure this week announced support for Docker in Azure. And I think there was some, you know, there's a lot of speculation about increasing support for Azure. I think we're going to see that over time. But I wanted to bring that up. So I don't know if anybody has any comments on that. Have you played with Docker at all, Greg?
I have not.
Okay. It looks very interesting. I just, it sort of came out of nowhere for me. I never saw it. And then a couple of weeks ago, I saw it and I started seeing the name everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's on that list of, you know, a million things to check out that, it's hard to stay up on.
Yeah. So I think this also shows, you know, pretty much anything that's going to be really popular in the developer community, we're going to see Azure supporting that in whatever capacity it's capable of doing. I mean, it's really a platform for running any type of application, you know, any type of language, you know, however it's built. You know, we'll take it. So that was the Azure pick of the week. Carl, you got the app of the week?
Yep. I decided to go with a non-technical one. So when I was growing up, I watched TV every night. I knew every night what I was, you know, what the schedule was. And now we've made the switch back to over the air. I don't have a DVR. So we're pretty much back on the live TV watching schedule again. So this week's app of the week is one that's for a Windows Store style app called TV Closet. And what this does, it's a TV tracking application. So you open it up, it'll just tell you out of the box, you know, what shows are on today and on tomorrow. And it'll tell you for all the networks, cable, over the air, so on and so forth. But if you create an account, you create an account with a different website it uses as a service called Trakt, TRAKT.com. You can create an account and just say, hey, I'm interested in like Grimm, and it'll save it to your favorites, and then it'll just show you when it's on. Because now that I'm only watching one or two episodes, you know, or shows a week, it's harder for me to remember, oh yeah, it's on Friday at this time, or maybe it moved. So I just thought this was a really well done app. It's styled really well.
Yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, it's really slick working. It works pretty nice. I signed up for it and started using it.
Yeah, I'm going to check this out. Excellent. Greg, do you have anything that you want to plug this week?
Plug, no, other than go and check out thatconference.com. But I realized there was one thing I wanted to mention about the enterprise Microsoft stack. Sure. For mobile, is that at Build, they announced that the kind of management solution that Microsoft has, you know, it was a monthly charge per device, and there was a lot of negative feedback on that. And so at Build, Microsoft announced that if you have an enterprise agreement, that's now of no cost to your company for as many devices as you have. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have an enterprise agreement, it's only a $100 one-time fee. And I think that's largely to thwart, you know, security hackers kind of thing, just get them registered. And so that's a significant change from, you know, enterprises originally looking at managing a whole bunch of Windows 8 kind of deployment devices. Now that cost is now removed, and I'm just trying to spread the word on that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So where can people find you online?
My blog is greglevenhagen.com. I'm assuming there'll be a link, so
yep.
I don't have to spell that out. And same thing for my Twitter handle. It's just my name, Greg Levenhagen. And, you know, follow me, send me a tweet, and I'll follow you back or whatever.
Perfect. Carl, where can we find you?
You can find me at WPDevGuy.com and also at Carl Schweitzer.
Perfect. So you can find me at ytechie.com. On Twitter, you can go to twitter.com/ytechie and you'll find me there. And then if you're going to be in the near Palo Alto next week, I'm going to be speaking on the industry panel at the Internet of Things World Conference. So that should be a good discussion. I'm going to be talking to a lot of people about the Internet of Things. So I think, you know, first priority is figuring out what do people think that is? And then, you know, like, what are people doing there? And, you know, what's going on there? So maybe we'll talk about that a little bit on our next episode.